thank you again, excuse me, for having me. I really enjoy getting to speak on this topic with churches because I think it's such an important topic for our time and for our moment. So I'm grateful to Westminster for letting me be here. I was trained in seminary, and in seminary you're trained to operate in threes when you're communicating. I don't know if you've noticed this from your pastors. So this is going to be a lecture of threes. So I'm going to give you three illustrations at the beginning. I'll make three overarching points. I will offer three challenges that we Presbyterians face in building relationships with Muslims. And I'll look at three possible bridge points where I think there's some prospect for hope. So my first illustration comes from a Pew study that they did. This was with data from 2010. And they were looking at the projected change based on current demographics, current trends, what will happen with the different religious populations of the world over the next few decades. And so, as you can see, on the left-hand side, you have absolute numbers of actual people, and on the right-hand side, you have percentage of humanity. So the Christian population over the next, I guess, 35, 32 years now, because they're projecting it out to 2050, will go from about 2.17 billion to about 2.92 billion people in the world that will identify with the Christian tradition. The Muslim population will go from about 1.6 billion, which it was in 2010. Right now it's probably more like 1.7, and that'll increase up to 2.76 billion people in the world will be Muslims. So in terms of percentage of global population, the percentage of people in the world who will be Christians because of the growth of the population as a whole will remain about the same. And the percentage of people who will be Muslim in 32 or so years will go from 23.2% to 29.7%. Now, when you get to 2070, those two lines intersect in terms of percentage. And so the reality is within our lifetimes, about one-third of the world will be Christian. About one-third of the world will be Muslim. And no matter what our immigration policies are here in the United States, no matter what Donald Trump tries to do keeping Muslims out, the reality is global encounters between Muslims and Christians are only going to increase because these are two growth populations in the world. So that's my first illustration. My second illustration, I want to talk a little about where Islam came from, and I'll give you just a really simple overview of what it means to be Muslim and how different Muslim groups evolved and developed. So when the tradition began, you had the early community led by the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century. And as far as we can tell, the Prophet Muhammad did not have any succession plan after his death. There was no clear plan for how the community would operate after his death. And you can imagine the Muslim tradition would have developed very differently had there been some sort of a succession plan. But shortly after his death, you had two different tendencies or trends emerge in terms of how they should think about the leadership of the community. Who should be the caliph? Who should be the person leading the community? And so on the Sunni side, they weren't originally calling themselves Sunnis, but it took time to congeal over time. But the Sunni side decided it should be the most qualified Muslim man, the most qualified member of the community elected by a council of elders. It was a very Presbyterian sort of way of governing the community. And on the other side were the Shia, who said that the family of the Prophet carried on the charismatic authority of the Prophet and were specially blessed by the Prophet. And so it should be a descendant or a relative of the Prophet who should carry on. Shia is short for Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali, the son-in-law of the Prophet who the Shia thought should be the first of the caliphs. So today, the vast, vast majority of Muslims are Sunni. It's about 80 to 85%, depending on whose numbers you're working with. But then you have the Shia making up about 10 to 15% of the Muslim community today. But within the Shia community, then there became a series of disagreements because each of the descendants of the Prophet, each of the generations of descendants, would claim to be the imam, the leader, the charismatic, infallible leader of the Shia community. And so some there was a split after five generations. And so some Shia followed the Zaydi trend and said there were only five imams. There were only five, and then the line of imams ended. There was a larger community that decided there were seven of these infallible imams, and they are called the Ismailis. And then the majority of Shia are what are called Twelvers, sometimes just called Imamites in English. And the Twelvers are what are the largest community of Shia. They are predominantly in Iraq and Iran. When Ayatollah Khomeini arose as kind of the leader in the, or one of the leaders in this 12er trend, he was so what the 12ers believe is that the 12th imam, the final imam, was taken away by God, this was in the late 9th century. And the 12th imam, as a child, was taken away by God and will only return at the end of time. And so what Khomeini claimed was that he, as a scholar, had the right to rule or the right to govern the community in the name of the 12th imam. This is, if you want a good vocabulary word for your cocktail parties, this is called the occultation of the 12th imam in Shia Islam. Now, within the Sunni community, there wasn't so much of this division over exactly how the succession would work, because there was generally consensus about who would be caliph. But the way that things actually played out in the Sunni tradition was there was more of a focus around jurisprudence. How do you take the teachings of the Quran, the Hadith, the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, and the actions of the Prophet Muhammad, and put that together into a way of life? As I've talked about a little bit before, in the Islamic tradition, theology is not that complicated. It's not they don't have all these paradoxes that we are burdened with as Christians. They don't have a divine human being and have to kind of work out exactly how those two things hold together. They don't have a trinity where somehow three beings in one person. So theology has been fairly simple. There's one God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. But then the question becomes, well, how do you work that out? How do you operationalize the concept of Islam in real life? And the majority of the conversation has been around jurisprudence. So they developed these four different major, what they call madhabs, schools of law, schools of interpretation, in which jurists would be operating and thinking and using their own kind of rules, the rules of their school, to kind of operationalize Islam, make it something that was accessible to people. And really within medieval Islam, there was a general tolerance of all four. There was kind of a mutual tolerance of all four. They all recognized each other as valid ways of being Muslim, of being Sunni. And so it was really more just slight variations in how you pray, slight variations in deciding what sorts of foods are allowed, what sorts of foods are not. But there's kind of a built-in pluralism to the Sunni tradition within these madhabs. Now, inhabiting all of that is a movement that is often called Sufism or Sufi mysticism. And the Sufis are not so much a sect of Islam as a spirituality of Islam. And so the Sufis, that you can be Shia or Sunni and be Sufi. You can belong to any one of the madhabs and be Sufi. So it's not a distinguishing mark in terms of, oh, I'm separate, or it's not a sectarian division, but it's more a way of being within Islam, a way of operating within Islam, trying to imitate the experience of the Prophet through kind of meditation, through remembrance, and through kind of direct connection to God. Now, with all of this comes geographical diversity throughout the medieval period. So some of the different schools of law and the different sects of the Shia are rooted in geographical differences or regional differences. You have different political overlays. You have different empires that arise within this that might favor one of the schools of law or give it privilege, but is not necessarily eradicating the others. And Quran and Hadith interpretations vary throughout this, right? So everyone's working with most of the same base materials in the Quran and the Hadith. The Shia add in some of their own Hadith from the Imams, giving them kind of equal or close billing with the Prophet, but there's all kinds of variation within Islam. And then you get into the modern period, and you have this movement that I spoke about some last week of the Salafis and the Wahhabis. And the Salafis and the Wahhabis grow out of the Hanbali madhab. They grow out of this Hanbali, which was always kind of the strictest, most kind of orthodox or fixated of the madhabs. But the Salafis basically overthrow the whole thing. They cast out all the madhabs and say, we don't trust any of those traditions of interpretation, as I talked about last week. They call themselves the Protestant reformers of Islam. And so they want to get back directly to the Quran and the Hadith, get back directly to interpretation. Let's not worry about all this tradition. The Salafis will often position themselves against the Sufis, which they see as a cultural accretion that has been added on top of Islam. And so they want to get back to what they see as pure and pristine original Islam. And what has happened in the midst of that is the people, the Muslims who have tended to prefer the old way, the traditional way, have started calling themselves, especially in the West, traditional Muslims. So traditional Muslims does not mean, oh, I think there's only one way to think about Islam. Traditional Muslims is when someone says typically in the West, I'm a traditional Muslim, what they mean is I like all the pluralism and complexity of the medieval tradition. They're typically Sunni, and that I like that I can have Sufism and these different schools of interpretation, and, right? It's a claim for the big tent approach to Islam over and against this more Salafi tendency to cast off all the tradition in favor of direct access to the text. So my main point with this diagram is just that there's no simple Muslim. There's no generic Muslim. There's no such thing as a generic Muslim that you'll just meet. Oh, they're just a general Muslim, right? Everyone has a complicated identity. Islam is every bit as diverse as Christianity. And speaking of Christianity, let me talk a little bit about Protestantism. So if you think about how the church was operating in the 15th century up until the Reformation, you had the Roman Catholic Church that has more or less remained fairly constant in its thinking and its operations. It has changed quite a bit, actually, since the 1960s with the Vatican II Conference. But more or less, the Catholic Church has remained as a coherent whole throughout the last five centuries. We, on the other hand, are very complicated. So you had these four major branches of the Reformation that grew out of these different disputes among the Protestants and against the Catholics often. So Luther obviously starts the Lutheran tendency. Our own Reformed tradition started by first Zwingli and then Calvin. The Anglican tradition started by Henry VIII and his attempt to get a divorce. And then the Radical Reformation, what scholars call the Radical Reformation, the Anabaptists. And then through the centuries, those have all developed their own complexities. So the Anabaptists gave us the Amish, right? The Amish and the Mennonites are two different subsects of the Anabaptists that grow out of them. And then ultimately, they gave us the Baptists of today, can trace their lineage back to the Radical Reformation. Within the Anglican tradition, obviously, you have the Church of England that continues today. But then you have a kind of breakoff movement in the Puritans that want to purify the Church of England, try to bring it to what they saw as more Orthodox Protestant roots. And then the Quakers are also derived from the Anglican tradition. The Reformed tradition helps out the Puritans and gives them some of their theology there. And then you have the Wesley brothers that start this movement called Methodism, another Reform movement within the Anglican Church. And then after the American Revolution, after we fight, or really while we're fighting a war with England, it's not very popular to go around saying, I'm a member of the Church of England. That sounds like you're betraying your country. So everyone started calling themselves Episcopalians, right? It's a little more politically savvy way to refer to yourself if you're in America. Within the Reformed movement, you had the Dutch Reformed up in northern continent of Europe, and then the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists all come out of there, the Presbyterians largely out of Scotland. Within the Lutheran tradition, most Lutherans just continue to call themselves Lutherans, but then there's this movement of Lutheran piety, the Pietists, that are, again, a Reform movement within Lutheranism. We Protestants love to just keep reinventing the wheel and trying to get back to our roots. And within the 19th century, really the late 18th century, I guess, you start to have this identity congealing that starts calling themselves evangelicals. And evangelicals are not a new sect so much as a unity movement drawing from many of the different branches of Protestantism to try to create, again, kind of a big tent ethos, an almost ecumenical Reform movement within the Protestant movement. that movement of evangelicals goes a little bit awry in the beginning of the 20th century, and you have this group of evangelicals that say, no, we're not evangelicals because that term has become too loosey-goosey. We're fundamentalists. We care about the fundamentals. And then also right around the same time, at the beginning of the 20th century, you have a breakoff movement from the evangelicals that starts calling themselves the Pentecostals. Right. So these are the various branches of Protestantism. And in the midst of all of that, our own tradition, the mainline, develops in the 1960s as its own identity. We're mainline Protestants. We're not fundamentalists. We're not evangelicals. We're not Pentecostals. We're the normal kind of Protestants, right? That's the implicit claim in the term mainline, right? We're normal. We're not like those people over there. In fact, we don't even really want anything to do with those people. We're traditional Protestants, you could say. And so there's a claim within the mainline Protestant movement that they are holding to the mainstream, even though the term is actually derived from a train line running outside of Philadelphia. There's kind of an implicit claim within that no, we're the normal kind of Protestants. We're traditional Protestants. It has been a long 500 years. And we Protestants know something or another about complicated identities and subdivided communities. So my first point is this. We all have complex, complicated, hyphenated identities. And there's no such thing as a generic Christian or a generic Muslim. So I sometimes introduce myself as a white evangelical background, Southern Californian, seminary-trained, mainline Protestant who teaches Islam at a Catholic university. And all of those things are true about me. And all of those things have shaped me. All of those things contribute to who I am when I come to an interreligious encounter. And so I don't speak for Christianity. I speak for Matt Taylor, right? I speak out of my own experience and background and perspective, just like all of us do, just like every Muslim does. So when we come to encounters with people who are religiously different than us, I think it behooves us to bring all that complexity to the table. It behooves us to bring and expect that on the other side of the table will be someone who doesn't speak for Islam, who doesn't speak for Judaism, but who speaks from their own experience, their own background, their own hyphenated identity. They could be a traditional Muslim, Hanafi madhab, Sufi devotee who comes from Morocco, right? And all of that will shape and inform the way that they think about Islam, the way that they speak about Islam. And they aren't going to be able to articulate for you some global, generic, neutral perspective because such a thing doesn't exist. So let me talk about some of the challenges that we encounter, especially as Reformed Christians, when we think about coming into these interreligious encounters. The first challenge that I see is our lack of natural theology. So natural theology is this concept within theological studies of what is the knowledge, what understanding of God can a person have that they can gain without revelation, just by human reason, just by dint of being human, of being a rational human being. What can we know about God? What can we derive from nature? What can we derive from generic human experience? What can we figure out about God? And we in the Reformed tradition have tended to not like this idea very much, right? We are scripture people. We are people who believe that revelation is incredibly important. So Calvin is obviously one of the kind of the touchstone of our tradition, and he has some different ideas about what non-Christians might possibly know about God. So he has this idea of the sensus divinitatis, the sense of the divine. He's reading Romans chapter 1, and this idea that we as human beings have the sense that we should know God, that we should return to God. And so Calvin kind of formalizes this. Human beings have a sense of the divine, not that it could ever save you. Not that it could ever lead you to God, even, because you are a reprobate, sinful human being. But maybe that these non-Christians have some sense that God exists. And then Calvin also has this idea of the semen religiosus, the seed of religion, right? The impulse to worship something, right? That every human being, he would say, has. that every human being has this desire to worship something beyond themselves. Again, not that that would ever lead you to the one true God, but it would at least be a part of your nature to try to worship some God. He also has this idea of common grace, right? The grace that is given to every human being. The grace that undergirds our societies, that gives us the ability to govern ourselves, that restrains violence in our cultures, right? The grace of God, when Jesus says that God makes his sun to shine on the just and the unjust, to Calvin, that's common grace. Now, that's a totally different category than saving grace. It's a totally different category than the redemption of Christ on the cross. But it's God's kindness to humanity, even the reprobate parts of humanity. I think all of those are wonderful ideas, but they fall far short of natural theology. The idea that human beings could somehow in their identities, in their nature, in their reflection, encounter the one true God and have a real interaction with that God, apart from the divine intervention in Jesus Christ or the divine revelation of the Bible. So, this has led to very little Reformed reflection on what other people might know and what we might have in common with them, what we might be able to interact with non-Christians about, what insight we might gain even from them. So the Catholic tradition has a very strong tradition of natural theology. Really, the pinnacle of it would probably be Thomas Aquinas in the 12th century. You have a lot of reflection within the Catholic tradition on what could rational people know about God? What could the philosophers understand about God? What did the pagans pre-Christianity get right about God? And there's a lot of dialogue because of this between philosophy and theology in the Catholic tradition. Because if you have a natural theology, then philosophy can be constructive theologically. We in the Protestant tradition have tended to say, no, you need revelation. And whatever those philosophers are talking about over there, that's fine. They can pursue their truth, but it's not revelation. It'll never get you to God. But probably the leading proponent of this in the 20th century is one of my favorite theologians, Karl Barth. And Barth is strictly against any conception of natural theology. Barth says that we know nothing about God apart from the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. We are nothing. And he casts doubt on even this conception of religion, right? Because he's like, what's the use of religion? It's all just human mucking about. It never gets you to God without Jesus Christ. And one of Barth's disciples, Emil Brunner, who's also within kind of this neo-Orthodox Reformed school of theology, at one point says, maybe, this is in the 1930s, 1940s, starts saying, maybe we could kind of have some conception of natural theology. Maybe there's some way that we could get to some form of a natural theology working with our Reformed paradigm. And so they have this famous dialogue between their two essays. And so Emil Brunner puts forth this very tentative, maybe we could do something along these lines. Maybe we can find something in Calvin, something in our tradition that will give us some footpath to a natural theology. And Karl Barth writes the rejoinder essay in the volume, and the title is one word, no! ! Right. So this and I think that has been more true. There have been people within our Reformed tradition who've tried to work on this some ways, but this has not been a big part of our tradition. So we have these other ideas, but we never really think that we have anything to learn from other religions because we have all the truth through revelation. So if you think back to the Protestant Reformation, there are five solas, the five slogans of the Protestant Reformation. Sola Scriptura, only Scripture. Sola Fide, only by faith. Sola Gratia, only by the grace of God. Solus Christus, only Christ. And then Soli Deo Gloria, right? Only for the glory of God. And the shadow side, in my view, of the five solas is that it's sola Christianity. We say sola Christus, only can people be saved by Christ. But what we really mean is only Christianity. Because we have no natural theology, because we have no history of reflecting on these things, we start to say we have a monopoly on the truth. we as Christians, not Christ has a monopoly on the truth. We as Christians have a monopoly on the truth because we're the only ones with revelation. We're the only ones with faith. We're the only ones who understand the grace of God. Right? This is, in some ways, the arrogance of the Protestant Reformation. So that's challenge number one, our lack of a natural theology. A second challenge that I see is our predestination theology. So the early Reformed debates were not about whether or not God predestines people to heaven. They were about whether or not God predestines people to hell. So this is called the debate between single versus double predestination. So Calvin early on very strongly wants to say, no, we believe that God predestines those who will be saved. Right? He's drawing this from Scripture. He's drawing it from different passages. And he says, no, God has to know in advance who will be saved, and God must be the one doing the electing. This is called the doctrine of election in our formal vocabulary. Right? And all of Calvin's followers come back and say, well, what about everyone else? If God is, before creation, electing some of us for salvation, why would he create anyone else? They must be created in order for damnation. God must have two predestinarian instincts. God must have the impulse to save some people and creates them for that end. And God must have the impulse to damn some people and creates them solely so that he can damn them. This is called the doctrine of double predestination. And Calvin is a little hesitant about this idea of double predestination because that does not reflect very well on the character of God. Nobody really likes to think about a God who creates people who never have any hope of salvation, who might experience a little bit of common grace along the way, who might have the seed of religion in them, but they were created only so that they would spend eternity in hell. It doesn't sit well with most of our souls. And Calvin, in the end, comes to conclude that that is the only logical way to read the Bible, but he says you cannot read anything into the character of God from this because it's a mystery. We don't know. But we can't read the Bible any other way, but you can't read anything into the character of God from this. Now, what this does practically is it really cuts short all of the Reformed missionizing and proselytizing efforts. There are some Protestant, Presbyterian missionaries. There are some Reformed, Dutch Reformed missionaries. But really, for the missionary movement within the Reformed tradition is largely out of duty rather than out of hope. Right? Because if God is going to save people, God's going to save people. And if God's not going to save people, all of our proclamation isn't going to make a damn bit of difference. So what we do often is, well, we were told to proclaim the gospel. Jesus sent us into the world. That's our Christian duty. But it's not like we have much hope of changing anyone's mind. Only God can change people's mind. And God has already picked who he's going to pick. So we'll do the missionary thing. But it's always been a little bit half-hearted, in my view, in the Reformed tradition. Or at least it's been motivated out of a sense of Christian duty rather than our sense of real participation in the work of God. Now, this once you have the decline of emphasis on predestination in the 20th century, around the middle of the 20th century, Karl Barth, who I just mentioned, really comes back and rethinks Calvin on this question, and I would say really changes the conversation within our Presbyterian and Reformed world. And I can talk more about how Barth does that if people are interested. But what this leads to is we used to be God's frozen chosen. Right, that used to be the thing we talked about as Presbyterians, as our kind of identity marker. We do everything decently and in order, and we know that we're predestined. Right? If you get rid of the predestined piece, or if you stop emphasizing that, well, you're just frozen. and I think it's led to a lot of apathy on our part about evangelism, about proclaiming the message of the Christian gospel, about reaching out to other people. Because we still have in the back of our heads that we're predestined. We know that we're supposed to do everything decently and in order, but what do we do about anything else? So you could argue that the lack of our missionary efforts is an advantage. We have less to apologize for in the world. because we a lot of the expansion of Protestant missionaries came along with colonialism, and the different colonial powers of Europe sent their armies of administrators, their armies of soldiers, and their armies of missionaries all together into the rest of the world, leading people to the glory of Christianity and often the glory of whatever empire they were working for. So that would seem like, well, that there's something good about that. But I work and have studied at a Jesuit institution. The Jesuits were a Catholic order that were founded during the Reformation, founded in many ways as a response to these Protestant efforts. And the Jesuits in the 16th century were going around the globe at the same time as the Protestants were having these bickering debates about who is the right kind of Protestant. The Jesuits were going to Japan. The Jesuits were going to China. The Jesuits were going to South America. If you've seen the film Silence, the Martin Scorsese film that came out, it's about Jesuit missionaries in Japan in the 18th century, right? But this, or excuse me, the 17th century. This is what these different missionary movements from other groups are doing. While we Protestants are having debates about single versus double predestination, they're going out and encountering people around the world. They're encountering other religions around the world. It's a very interesting film just came out in December. It's on PBS, and it's called The Sultan and the Saint, and it's about St. Francis and his attempt during the Crusades to go and convert the Muslim Sultan in Egypt. He decides that he has been called by God to either be martyred by the Muslims or convert the Sultan, and he's not successful in either respect, but he winds up forming a friendship with the Sultan. They have this kind of meeting of the minds, meeting of the hearts in Egypt in the 13th century. And I think there's something powerful about that. A lot of the impulse towards interreligious encounter starts in proselytism. It starts in us thinking that we are right, and then we meet somebody else and discover that they have an interesting perspective as well. Right? And in our world, I would much prefer the encounter of missionaries over the clash of civilizations. I would much prefer that people are out there trying to win each other and persuade each other over to their religious perspective than assuming that they have to fight it out. So alongside our lack of missionary effort and our predestinarian theology, we have our limited colonial encounter. Again, might be a good thing in many cases, but it has its disadvantages as well. In our inheritance. Where did Reformed Christians colonize? Well, you had the Dutch that colonized South Africa. There's a very interesting talk that we had at the Reformed Institute at our convocation a couple years ago by Alan Bosak, who is one of the anti-apartheid black South African Reformed theologians who participates and really pushes some of the anti-apartheid movement in the late 20th century. If you want to see some of how that whole situation got cleaned up. But there aren't a lot of Muslims in South Africa. At least there weren't in the colonial era. We colonized Indonesia, which is largely Muslim, or excuse me, the Dutch colonized there. We Presbyterians might not take responsibility for that. But from all we can tell, the Reformed folks weren't very interested in missionizing Indonesia. Even though they're surrounded by Muslims, the Lutherans were much more active as missionaries in Indonesia than the Dutch Reformed were. And we colonized America. Scots came and colonized here in the U.S. Our own tradition, the Presbyterians, came and colonized here. And that's mostly white people and the Native Americans that we drove out of the different areas where they colonized. So the upside of this is that we have very little to apologize for in the modern world. The downside is we have very little shared history of relationship. If you think about the Church of England had to understand Hindus and had to understand Muslims because they had colonized them. And even if it was an imperial, orientalist, somewhat hostile encounter, it was still an encounter. There's a history of relationships, and you can build from relationships. But we, in our frozen, chosen model, have tended not to even have the relationships that are founded by this. So this is the second lesson that I will draw, the overarching lesson. There's very little in our Reformed and Presbyterian tradition and outlook that would naturally lead us into interreligious engagement. some ways there's an advantage to having things to apologize for, because you can repair relationships. We don't have relationships. So if we are going to get to know Muslims, or really any religious others, it will require that we leave the comfortable orbits of our regular Presbyterian lives. It will require that we step outside of our own spaces where we feel comfortable and safe. Let me talk about three bridge points that I see. And I think I use this image of a bridge because I think it's important that we think about not just where we might feel a little bit comfortable, where we might draw a little close to Islam, but where Muslims might draw a little closer to us, right? You need to build the bridge from both sides of the river at a place that is convenient to both sides. So my first bridge point is our predestinarian theology. So Muslims actually have a very strong belief in God's providence. They have a very strong belief in the eternal predestination of human souls. Right? So when in the midst of all of this colonial encounter, as all of these different branches of Christians and all these different Catholic missionaries are encountering Islam or trying to make sense of Islam, there's a phrase that keeps coming up over and over again. This is a very Calvinist religion. People keep calling Islam a very Calvinist religion because there's such an interest in the providence of God, the sovereignty of God, the predestination of God. So people keep making this analogy between, oh, those Muslims, they're a lot like the Calvinists. Of course, the Calvinists aren't there because they aren't doing that much missionary work. But everyone else is like, there's something really in common between the Calvinists and these Muslims over here. So I think, and I would say, just as somebody who often occupies the margins of the conversation of Reformed theology, my thinking is that the unexplored side, that maybe what we can work on in the next century in Reformed theology, the unexplored side of this idea of predestination and providence is, did God really just like Mediterranean and European people for about 1,500 years? Or is God somehow at work in the rest of the world and in the other world religions? See, the dark side of this predestinarian theology, there's several dark sides to our predestinarian theology, but when we start saying God is divinely provident, God provides everything that human beings need, and God is divinely sovereign and orchestrates all of human living and life, which are good parts of our theology, when we posit that, what about everyone else? There's a subtle racism to claiming this doctrine of predestination that can only be manifested in Christianity. Because Christianity, up until the modern period, was largely a Western European tradition. It starts in the Mediterranean. And there's still all kinds of Christians who aren't Western. But from our perspective, especially if you think that Calvinism is the only path to God, most Calvinists are white people. It's changing a little bit, but most Calvinists historically are white people. So does God just have a racial preference in who God predestines, or is God somehow potentially at work? And if we really believe that God is the sovereign God, could that God not interact with people of other religions? Could that God not somehow embed messages about God's self in Islam, in Judaism, in Buddhism, in Hinduism? Could there not be reflections of the divine character in these other religious traditions that we might even be able to learn something from? Because our God is the God of the whole world. Another bridge point I see is in our claim to do everything decently and in order. Most Muslims have a very similar aesthetic. They're similar to us Presbyterians in their temperament and their aesthetics. But in between both traditions, what I would call an iconoclastic aesthetic. That's a bit of a paradox, I guess. Iconoclasm is the tearing down of images, the tearing down of any image that might mediate between us and God. A very common trend within monotheism. If there's only one God, and that God is not analogous to anything in our world, then nothing comes between us and that God. And so within the Reformed traditions, there's been a very strong tendency. Even things like music can be things that come between us and God. And different Reformed traditions said maybe we shouldn't have music in our worship, right? Maybe we shouldn't have anything in our any images in our sanctuary. My own congregation at Georgetown Presbyterian, which is the top picture there, the only decorations in our sanctuary, apart from like Christmas and seasonal decorations that sometimes get put up, are 8 panels around the sanctuary that have quotations from the Bible. Right? And at one point, before I got there, our new pastor had come in, and we have a communion table at the front of the sanctuary. And she said, you know, on the weeks that we aren't doing communion, what if we just put a 1-foot cross on the table? And there was uproar. So people said, that's not what we do. We're Presbyterian, right? So there, this iconoclastic tendency is very deep in us, I think. We are suspicious of all of those icons. We can't quite figure out what all those Eastern Orthodox people are doing with their icons, or what those Catholic people are doing with their saints and these images, right? We want plain. We want simple. We want the Word. And it's very true in Islam as well. Very strong iconoclastic tendency in Islam, including by the Salafis. We have relatively hierarchy-less communities. We think that that congregations should, by and large, govern themselves with some supervision from the presbyteries, although I think we're always a little bit suspicious of the presbyteries. And that's true for Muslims as well. Most Muslim communities, most mosques, have a similar mode of governing that we have. They operate in much the same mode that we do. And Muslims worship in a very simple and proper way. Right? They know what they're supposed to do at every moment in a prayer service. They know when they're supposed to stand up, when they're supposed to sit down, when they're supposed to kneel. They know exactly how things go. They're decently and in order. Right? I have a friend. She's a Saudi Arabian Muslim. She's helping me do some language learning with the Saudi dialect. And she's here in D.C. studying at Georgetown. And at one point, she invited herself to a Christmas service at our church. She said she wanted to come to a Christmas service at our church. And my wife and I said, of course. So she came into our congregation. And after about 10 minutes of this Christmas service, where we're singing our hymns and we know when to stand up and when to sit down, we've got our nice bulletins in front of us, she turns to me and she says, it feels like a mosque. And it's true. Our church feels like a mosque. There's only the Word of God on the walls. Right? There's a very simple aesthetic. There's a very straightforward, and I mean, we even have in our congregation, the focus, right, is towards the front of the congregation. There's almost there's an alcove at the front, which is very similar to the mihrab, right? They're very similar to the orientation towards Mecca that is in every one of the mosques. Right? So I think we have more in common with Muslims aesthetically than we might assume. My last bridge point is what I would call the legacy of the Reformation. I talked about this a little bit last week, but we have spent the last 500 years learning lessons, often negatively learning lessons through mistakes and errors. But I think we have gained some insights in the last 500 years, both as Protestants and as Reformed people. We've learned that, I hope we've learned, that freedom of religion and freedom of conscience are duties that we owe each other. I hope we've learned that lesson. With all of our intra-Protestant spats, all of our fights, all of our wars that we've fought over religion and who's right, I think the conclusion most of us have come to is that we owe each other the right to practice and to believe and to decide for ourselves what we should believe. It's a hard-fought lesson that we've gained. And I think it's something that we have to offer the rest of the world. Now, I purposely phrased it this way because I'm suspicious of the language of human rights. As a Reformed theologian, I'm always suspicious of any claim of human beings to hold on to something that is ours. There's a selfishness to that. I'm claiming my rights against you. I think we as Reformed people might want to think more in terms of our duties. The duties that we owe each other. What is due our neighbor? Not what I can claim as my right. I think that Jesus would have probably talked a lot more about the duties that we owe our neighbor than the rights we claim against them. Right? What is the principle of servant leadership? What's the principle of sacrificial friendship? Say, the duties that we owe to our fellow human beings. So when many people talk about Muslims don't respect freedom of religion, which is a silly thing to say, but many people will frame things that way. I come back to, well, what do we owe? It's not what do we demand, it's what do we owe people. My second lesson that I hope we've learned is that sometimes we're using different words to say the same thing. In the last 50 years or so, there's been a remarkable movement. There's this big reform in the Catholic Church at Vatican II in the 1960s that really opened the door for a great deal of ecumenical and interreligious dialogue from the Catholic side. There's been a remarkable transformation in the Lutheran and Reform, or the Lutheran and Catholic conversation especially, where the Lutherans and the Catholics have started this dialogue for a number of decades. And in 1999, Lutheran theologians and the leaders of the Lutheran churches around the world and the Catholic theologians and the leaders of the Catholic Church, especially I think that it was Pope John Paul still at that point, got together and they signed a joint declaration on justification. If you know anything about Reformation history, justification was really at its base what most of the fight was about. How are we made right with God? And these Lutheran theologians and leaders and these Catholic theologians and leaders started to realize we actually have a lot more in common on this question, and we've grown a lot closer over the last 500 years than all the polemics of the 16th century would lead you to believe. And there was this joint agreement, this joint acknowledgement. We're actually on the same page on this one. We can tolerate the minor differences that we have. We recognize that we're on the same page. And in fact, in some ways, the vagaries of the Reformation led to these different vocabularies that we have. If you go underneath the vocabularies, we're actually saying most of the same things. Same thing has happened with the Roman Catholic Church and many of the so-called heretical churches of the ancient world, these churches that were cast out from these different church councils as being heretical, the Nestorian churches, the Oriental Orthodox churches. And the Roman Catholic Church, through a number of different dialogue events, has realized we've remembered the history wrong. We were saying the same thing and using different words. We had the same ideas, but we're using different words. Now, this is not the sort of kumbaya, we're all on different paths up the same mountain kind of mentality. This is hard work of dialogue. But in fact, our own Reformed tradition, our Reformed leaders and theologians signed on to that same declaration last year in the anniversary of the Reformation. They signed on to that same joint declaration on justification. I think the lesson that we might take away is that we might still be saying different things, but if we get underneath our language, do we have some of the same conceptions, some of the same emotions, some of the same hopes that are embedded in our different vocabularies? Finally, one of the lessons I think we've learned in the last 500 years is that perfect agreement is not required for mutual respect and cooperation. Part of the fragmenting that happened in the Reformation and the social dynamics of that, what it created was the sense that my community of Protestants, my Reformed tradition or my Lutheran tradition is the only way to do Protestantism. And those damned Methodists are wrong, right? That Church of England is heresy, right? And over the last 500 years, in part through some of this ecumenical dialogue that we've done, we started to realize, well, I still prefer the Reformed formulations, but I can get along with the Lutherans. I still prefer my own liturgy, but I understand why people like the Church of England. Right? I understand why someone could be an Episcopalian. Right? They aren't heretical for being that way. We've come to the realization that we can respect and cooperate with people who might not be marching in lockstep ideologically and theologically with us 100%. We can accept the 90% agreement that we have. So I may not be able to swallow the doctrine of papal infallibility, but I like Pope Francis. And I teach at a Catholic institution, and I learn all kinds of things from my Catholic colleagues. Learned a lot about theology from being there. So I think that's a lesson that we can take away from our 500-year journey. It's that there can be a lot in common. It doesn't have to be everything. So this is my last point. There are many starting points for dialogue and exchange. And sometimes, especially the Catholics have discovered this, because they've done so much more work in interreligious dialogue since Vatican II, sometimes starting with theology is not very helpful. The Catholics divide it out and say that there's a dialogue of faith, and that's important. What about the dialogue of life? The dialogue of a shared meal? And talking about how eating works in Islam, how Muslims think about food, how they interact with food. What about the dialogue of service together? What about the dialogue of worship together? That can be a really hard one for us Protestants. But what if we could go and sit in a mosque and pray to Jesus? What if Muslims could come and worship in our services and think about their own tradition in the midst of that? So sometimes it can be I'm all in favor of theological dialogue. It's a lot of what I do with my life. But I think a lot of times it's not the right starting point, especially if that's not your specialization. Right? Because then you feel this need to represent the Reformed tradition. And many of us don't feel like we even know what the Reformed tradition is. But we have to speak for it. And Muslims, in the same way, if it starts with theology, they feel like they have to represent the entire complexity of the Islamic way of thinking about the Trinity, and they don't know that much about that. And so they're going to make bald and often inaccurate statements just like we do. Right? But if we can start with life together, then I think we might have a better starting point. My last thought is this. What if we came to see ourselves as American Presbyterians as welcoming hosts to Muslims? I interact with a lot of Muslims in our society, and they're very worried right now. The demonizing language that has been used and is being used in Europe as well against Muslim communities, they feel that, and they know the history of Europe. They know the history of America. They know the history of Japanese internment. They know the history of concentration camps. They know where demonizing rhetoric can lead when a political moment turns. And they're very worried right now. And most Muslims in the United States are incredibly open to interfaith dialogue because they feel like it's an existential need. Because they feel like they don't have anywhere else to go to find advocates. Because they don't have a lot of cultural capital. We do. We're doctors and lawyers and biologists, and we're upstanding people. We're mainline Protestants. We own American society, or at least we did once upon a time. And we have cultural capital. And there's an incredible ministry, there's an incredible witness of hospitality that I think we can offer to our Muslim neighbors, welcoming them and even, in some cases, shielding them from the worst elements of our culture right now. Thank you. I have a few minutes for questions. Yes. That's okay.
During the week.
Yeah.
And I like that. And on Friday in the morning, their sanctuary, Muslims come and have a service in their faith.
Yeah.
People are, anyone can come and hear the service.
I think sometimes we assume as Christians that our Christian spaces are going to feel unwelcoming to Muslims. So at Georgetown, Georgetown has built a very good relationship, especially with the Arab Muslim world. A lot of the Arab heads of state want to send their kids to Georgetown. So we have a lot of Muslim students there. And at one point, there are crosses, there are crucifixes in every classroom at Georgetown. At one point, a number of liberal Catholics at Georgetown and some secular folks at Georgetown came forward and said, "Let's take down all the crosses. They're going to offend the Muslims." And so some people started asking the Muslims, like, "Oh, we don't care. That's fine. We knew it was a religious school. That's why we wanted to come here. Right? We wanted a place where we felt like we could practice our faith." Right. So to them, that's not threatening to have a cross in the classroom, right? And it's not threatening to be in a church sanctuary. We assume, that maybe there's some discomfort there. But for many Muslims, they know that they are not the majority in this society, and they've learned to compensate for that. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah, the Quran refers to Jews and Christians in this other third category that we still don't know quite who they are, the Sabians, as people of the book. So that is the way of Muslims kind of thinking about Christians and Jews. They'll still talk about that. The better translation would probably be people of the scriptures, al-kitab. Let me maybe frame it slightly differently. Every new monotheistic tradition has to accommodate and understand the previous monotheistic traditions. Because if we believe there's only one God and that God has been consistent, well, we need to figure out how God has worked before us. So when Christianity comes along, Christianity emerges out of Judaism, right? Jesus and all of his followers are Jewish. And there's a several hundred years period of distinguishing and separation between rabbinic Judaism and Orthodox Christianity. That process of separation, in the midst of that, there are many imperial claims that Christians start making, that Christianity has superseded Judaism. We have bypassed Judaism. We have encapsulated Judaism and incorporated. We are the new Israel as the church, right? So that's this idea of supersessionism. So when Islam comes along, and we only really within the last 100 years have we, really even post-Holocaust, have we started to really grapple with, well, maybe we need to let go of that supersessionist interpretation. When Islam comes along in the 7th century, it makes a very similar move. So this claim that the people of the book have received these previous revelations, it's both welcoming and it's a takeover, right? Because the Quran is claiming to be the final revelation, the final instantiation. And in fact, it makes points about the Christians and Jews got their scriptures wrong. And now you have a clear book, right? So there's both an invitation, a recognition that we all worship the same God, and a little bit of a rhetorical move to encapsulate everything that came before. And depending on how you interpret the Quran, you can emphasize either side of that, right? It can be a very inclusive message, or it can be repudiation of all previous monotheisms because the final one has arrived, right? And different Muslims will interpret that in different ways. But it's definitely a dominant concept from the Quran that's still very much a part of the discourse. I'm happy to stick around for a few minutes, but I think we're out of time. So thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.